So, it's time to come to a conclusion, or you won't be able to ask me any questions. And the question originally was, is education natural? This is the last slide. I've put the question mark in brackets because the picture actually is a watershed. It's not controversial. That's Loch Dochard, which is at the watershed between Glen Etive and Glencoe in the Scottish Highlands. But the watershed that I've got in mind is this. Jared Diamond and others have suggested that we are now, or we are about to become, in a completely new situation in our relationship with the rest of non-human nature. And the reason is this. You remember that for the Easter Islanders, Easter Island was their world. There was no other. There was nowhere else for them to go. That was it. For the Greenland Norse, the same thing was true. There wasn't really any going back to Norway. They lived in two fjords in western Greenland, and that was the world. That was what they knew. That was what they had available to them. And the point is that just possibly now, with our global technologies, with the demands that we are making, particularly on natural wastes, natural sinks for waste, such as particularly the atmosphere and the oceans, we have reached to the point, we've reached the point where our whole world is the whole world. And if that is so, then what these lessons from history tell us is that we really do need to be very careful, and because if we don't, then the ecosystem that supports us all is perfectly capable of flipping over into a state which, from a human point of view, would be entirely barren, if that's true. So the answer to my question is this. Education is perfectly natural. It's completely natural. It is actually the thing which defines our nature. It's who we are, it's what we are. But the way that it usually works is that we use education as a way of generating variety in our societies, and then some kind of selection takes place between one and another. But just possibly now, we're in a situation where the selection might be between us and something else. Something that isn't us at all, like cockroaches. And if that were true, then we would need to devise a sort of education that found a way of coping with that problem. And that might be something that didn't advocate any kind of final solution, but rather what we called earlier ecological resilience, a view that knows the difference between what we know and what we merely believe or are convinced of or think the latest available evidence best supports, because they're not the same thing at all. A form of education which, like the Inuit, is fully aware of the value of scientific inquiry and detailed, precise knowledge, but also understands that all only works so far when you can't even specify the variables that you're up against. And this would be a sort of education that would be quite unnatural. And perhaps that's what we ought to do.
Now, here's the podcast with which we open the show. This is by Professor Clive Hamilton from the 5th of March, 2013, from the Sydney Ideas podcast series.
Well, good evening, everyone. My name is Rosemary Lister. I'm the Professor of Climate and Environmental Law here at Sydney Law School and also the Director of our Centre, which is the Australian Centre for Climate and Environmental Law. So my colleagues and I have been following the climate change issues, particularly from a legal but also an interdisciplinary perspective, for many years. So I'm really very, very delighted to be able to welcome you here on behalf of Sydney Ideas to hear Clive Hamilton talk about his new book. Yesterday, you may have noticed that the Australian Climate Commission released its latest report called The Angry Summer, and it describes how in the 90 days of this past summer, 123 climate records were broken. And this includes the hottest summer ever and the most extreme ever daily rainfall event. So what we're seeing here and also in other parts of the world is consistent with the warnings that have been given us by scientists over decades and which are becoming only more insistent. We're expecting the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change to release its latest report, in June this year. And I guess the question for all of us, and I'm sure it's why you're here, is to ask ourselves the question, how should humankind be responding to the extreme climate events and indeed disasters about which scientists are warning? Now, this evening we're going to hear from Clive Hamilton about how various scientific, engineering, economic, corporate, private, including Bill Gates and Richard Branson, military and government forces are converging to play God with the Earth's climate rather than commit to decarbonizing the emissions by 90% by 2050 as the scientists are demanding. Now, as you read Earth Masters, some of you may have already done so, you will be gripped by a sense of disbelief. You'll want to tell yourselves that you are reading a page-turning airport novel. But of course, it is a very serious, fully referenced account of a technology which is bolting before its democratic, ethical, and regulatory parameters have been fully investigated and resolved. Well, how is it that the development and deployment of this type of technology is being regarded in some quarters as mandatory under international climate law? And I think that some part of that blame must fall on the irresponsibly slow international climate negotiations. So one may be tempted to draw some comfort from the latest negotiations in Doha in December last year, where two important decisions were taken. Going into Doha, all that developed and developing countries had agreed upon to replace the Kyoto Protocol, which in fact expired in December last year, were voluntary emissions reduction commitments. But at Doha, two decisions were taken. The first was that the Kyoto Protocol will be extended, and in fact, that second period commenced on the 1st of January this year. Now, under this agreement, developed countries have agreed to reduce their emissions by between 25 to 40% by 2020, which is what scientists have asked for. Unfortunately, however, Canada, Russia, and Japan have withdrawn from the protocol, and the US has never ratified it. So this leaves the developed economies of the EU, Australia, and Norway in the protocol, but these developed country emissions only represent 15% of global emissions. So what was the second decision? The second decision was to develop, and I'll read the words for you, a protocol or other legal instrument or an agreed outcome with legal force under the Climate Change Convention to come into effect on the 1st of January 2021. And this will cover both developed and developing country commitments. The text of this agreement has to be agreed to by December 2015. Well, I guess the question that many of you must be asking is, can we wait this long? The International Energy Agency warned us in December last year that their assessment of current commitments puts us on a pathway to a temperature increase of 3.6 degrees, and if emissions continue to rise, 6 degrees. Now, there's only a 5-degree temperature change between now and the last ice age. So I guess that the question is, are we left only with geoengineering? Is it our last hope? Well, Clive Hamilton is very well placed to take us on the geoengineering journey this evening. He is the Vice Chancellor's Chair and Professor of Public Ethics at Charles Sturt University in Canberra. He's been a visiting academic at the University of Oxford and Yale University. He was recently appointed to a statutory authority, the Climate Change Authority. He's a member of the Royal Society's Solar Radiation Management Governance Initiative, which he'll tell you about, and he's the author of a number of books, including Requiem for a Species. Please welcome Clive Hamilton to the podium.
Many thanks, Rosemary, for that introduction and the background, which is very helpful, and to Sydney Ideas for putting on this event. Well, climate scientists have watched with mounting alarm as carbon dioxide concentrations have increased relentlessly. And the anxiety has deepened each year as it's become clearer that the range of emission paths mapped out by experts in the late 1990s and early 2000s were unduly optimistic. We can see here that the coloured lines are the IPCC emission scenarios. You can see the one A1FI, which is the red one there, was kind of the worst case scenario, and the black dotted line is the actual growth in emissions, boosted, of course, by explosive growth in China. And so the actual growth of emissions in the 2000s has described a path that's worse than the worst-case scenario. And alarm has spread to staid organisations like the International Energy Agency. In 2011, it declared, on planned policies, rising fossil fuel use will lead to irreversible and potentially catastrophic climate change. And late last year, a report by the World Bank, which of course has funded huge amounts of investments in fossil energy over the last decades, the World Bank warned that we're on track for a 4-degree centigrade warmer world marked by extreme heat waves, declining global food stocks, loss of ecosystems and biodiversity, and life-threatening sea level rise. Now, it's hard to communicate to the public what a world warmed by 4 degrees will be like, or even that the IEA and the World Bank should be taken seriously, although this kind of does the trick for me. After all, for many people, one unseasonable snowstorm is enough to nullify decades of scientific study. And psychologists have done experiments where they've got a whole bunch of people in a room and asked them about climate change and their beliefs. And when they take account of all the other factors that might influence their beliefs on the science of climate change, when people are asked, they find they're significantly more likely to agree that global warming is a proven fact if the psychologists turn up the thermostat in the room. So for at least a decade, climate scientists have been disturbed by the widening gap between the actions demanded by the evidence and those being implemented or even considered by the major polluting nations. At the same time, their work began to focus on the dangers of feedback effects in the climate system, that is, processes that amplify or dampen the direct warming effect of rising greenhouse gases. For example, as warming melts the Arctic ice cap, the exposed water is darker than the highly reflective ice that it replaces, and so the water absorbs more heat from the sun. And many in the expert community received a fright in 2005 and 2007 at the extent to which the Arctic sea ice retreated in summer. And of course, the melting of the sea ice this past northern summer set new records. The study of feedback effects has been closely related to another idea emerging in the scientific literature, that of tipping points. Here's a map to show what are thought to be the potential tipping points which might see the Earth's climate system rapidly shift from one state to another. So a tipping point, small changes in one element of the climate system might initially have only small effects, but a threshold point can be reached where it flips into a new state. And paleoclimatologists have discovered many instances in the Earth's geological record of the climate shifting abruptly from one state to another, at times within a few decades. The esteemed paleoclimatologist Wally Brocker has warned, "The paleoclimate record shouts out to us that, far from being self-stabilising, the Earth's climate system is an ornery beast which overreacts to even small nudges." Against this background, climate scientists began to talk about possible responses to a climate emergency, such as a massive methane release with rapid melting of permafrost, the collapse of the West Antarctic ice sheet, or rapid dieback of the Amazon forests. Any of these potentially could quickly shift the global climate to a new state, and once it happens, there'd be no going back. How, they asked, could we intervene to prevent these things happening? If Plan A, persuading the world to cut greenhouse gas emissions, is failing, shouldn't we have a Plan B? In the 1990s, proposals for geoengineering were regarded by the mainstream as fanciful and a distraction of the real task of carbon abatement. But the longer political leaders prevaricated, the louder the silence surrounding geoengineering became. And so in 2006, the eminent Dutch atmospheric scientist Paul Crutzen wrote an editorial essay calling on fellow scientists to begin researching Plan B. That someone of Paul Crutzen's stature and undoubted commitment to protecting the natural world, he was described in Time magazine as the chief scientific caretaker of life on the planet for his work on the ozone hole, that Crutzen should call for serious research into geoengineering as a response to climate change should give pause for thought. Geoengineering presents a profound dilemma for all those concerned about the environment. Many find repellent the idea, embodied in some geoengineering schemes, of taking control of and regulating the Earth's climate as a whole. It is, surely, the ultimate expression of humankind's technological arrogance. Yet, if the alternative is to stand back and watch humanity plunge the Earth into an era of irreversible and hostile climate change, what is one to do? By early 2009, 3 years after Paul Crutzen opened the floodgates, more than half of leading scientists who responded to a poll conducted by the Independent newspaper agreed that, quote, the situation is now so dire that we need a backup plan. Over half agreed with that, 54%. And that was before the Copenhagen fiasco. One third disagreed with the proposition, not because they assessed the situation differently, but because they believed that the better response is to commit more strongly to Plan A, cutting emissions. And so in the last few years, interest in research into various schemes to engineer the climate has been accelerating rapidly. Geoengineering may be defined as deliberate, large-scale intervention in the climate system designed to counter global warming or offset some of its effects. More than 40 schemes have been put forward, with some of them the subject of intensive research. And they're usually divided into two types. The first type is known as carbon dioxide removal methods, and I've illustrated three of them here. One is air capture. This is a mock-up of a sort of large bank of machines that suck air in and extract by simple chemical means the carbon dioxide from it, concentrate the carbon dioxide, and then pipe it to be buried using carbon sequestration technology somewhere under the ground, one hopes, permanently. The second is known as liming the ocean. The oceans, the upper layers of the oceans, absorb large amounts of carbon dioxide. Well, it maintains an equilibrium. But as the oceans become more acidic, they absorb less of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. So the idea is to counteract the acidification of the oceans by spreading lime in the oceans and thereby assisting the oceans to absorb more carbon dioxide. And here's an example of the calcination of lime, which is what they do in the manufacture of cement. And the third carbon dioxide removal method is biochar, very popular, a lot of supporters. Essentially, biochar is created by burning or heating organic material of any type, really, in an anoxic environment, that is, without oxygen. It turns into charcoal. And this fixes the carbon very strongly in the biochar, which is then spread across paddocks or fields, and it helps moisture retention in the soil and stays stable for, one hopes, many hundreds of years. The second kind of geoengineering technology is known as solar radiation management. If the Earth is getting too hot, Can we reduce the amount of sunlight reaching the Earth's surface and cool the planet that way? And various schemes have been proposed, painting roofs white to increase the Earth's albedo, or reflectivity, reflecting more of the solar energy back into space, although there aren't enough roofs or indeed roads to paint white to really make much of a difference. A second is to install in space a large number, perhaps millions of very small mirrors at a particular geostationary orbit, which would reflect a proportion of incoming solar radiation, you know, around the Earth, so that the Earth thereby is cooled. And a third, and actually a particularly interesting and important proposal of solar radiation management, is so-called marine cloud brightening. And this involves a fleet of specially created ships. This is just a mock-up, of course, spraying micro droplets of seawater into the air to aid the formation of low-lying marine clouds that would reflect some additional sunlight back into space. Some a quarter or a third of the world's oceans are covered in these low-lying cumulus marine clouds. But let me describe in a bit more detail what I think are the two leading proposals for geoengineering, and they are ocean iron fertilisation and sulphate aerosol spraying. Well, what about ocean iron fertilisation? Well, when we dig up and burn fossil carbon, we obviously extract the energy trapped in the coal or oil or natural gas. But of course, the carbon atoms, after we've extracted the energy, don't just disappear. They have to go somewhere. So where do they go? Well, first they go, of course, into the atmosphere as carbon dioxide. Some is then soaked up by vegetation. And some, sooner or later, ends up in the various layers of the oceans. And the deep ocean has the capacity to absorb very large amounts of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And so, scientists think, it would help if we could get more carbon down to the deeps of the ocean and hope that it stays there. But how do we get carbon down to the deep ocean? Well, the answer lies, perhaps, in what is known as the biological pump. Tiny marine creatures known as phytoplankton grow by combining in the water, upper layers of the oceans, carbon dioxide, various minerals and sunlight to multiply into blooms, algal blooms. And on death, gravity causes the plankton to sink, taking the carbon with them to the bottom of the ocean, where it's hoped it will accumulate and remain stable for centuries, thousands of years, hopefully. The effectiveness of the biological pump depends on the suitability of conditions for marine life, including the availability of micronutrients, especially iron. If a shortage of iron in some patch of ocean is limiting plankton growth, then perhaps the artificial addition of the missing ingredient can stimulate algal blooms, which will then take carbon dioxide out of the upper layers of the water, which will then absorb more CO2 from the atmosphere. Fertilising some areas of ocean with a kind of iron slurry does indeed induce algal blooms. But it turns out that much of the carbon fixed in the phytoplankton does not find its way to the ocean floor, but circulates in the surface waters, feeding the food chain, before being emitted as carbon dioxide back into the atmosphere. And while iron fertilisation stimulates biological productivity in one area, nutrient stealing can see it decline in others. As one expert said, you might make some of the ocean greener by iron enrichment, but you're going to make a lot of the ocean bluer. It's been estimated that a massive iron fertilisation effort over, say, 100 years could absorb perhaps 3% of the cumulative emissions from burning fossil fuels over the same period. In the meantime, ocean acidification and rising temperatures would reach a level at which algal populations could be, probably would be, severely reduced. And this is one reason why climate engineering without emission cuts would be disastrous. The Southern Ocean, huge ocean area surrounding the Antarctic, over which Australia has extensive jurisdiction. The Southern Ocean seems attractive as a site for accelerating the biological pump because the potential productivity due to high levels of macronutrients is constrained by low levels of iron, a micronutrient. But hopes that iron fertilisation could provide a substantial response to global warming waned in 2009 after the so-called LOHEFEX experiment carried out in the Southern Ocean by a team of German and Indian scientists. They found that the biological pump only works well enough in oceans rich in silicon, because silicons are needed by a particularly effective kind of phytoplankton known as diatoms. Here they are, the little creatures here. And these diatoms are thought to be particularly useful as a type of photoplankton for absorbing carbon because they form hard glassy shells. And it means that the carbon trapped in is more likely to find its way to the bottom of the ocean, and partly because diatoms are less favoured by predators and sink more quickly before they can dissolve back into the water. Now, most oceans do not have enough silicon to promote rapid diatom growth, so iron fertilisation would work best if targeted at the silicon-rich third of the Southern Ocean. Incidentally, the role of iron in the oceans is extremely interesting. There have been a couple of studies that have shown that in the paleoclimate record, the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has been reduced substantially. It's thought by a sort of natural enrichment of oceans, particularly in the Southern Ocean, due to dust storms blowing iron-enriched dust off South America and Patagonia into the Southern Ocean, leading to very large algal blooms which have taken carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and thereby cooled the planet. It's just by the by. The deployment of full-scale iron fertilisation, it's been estimated, in the Southern Ocean could be done, or the conditions seem to be suitable, in about a third of the Southern Ocean, which is around 5% of the Earth's surface. But if that were to happen, then that could serve as a sink for about a tenth of the world's excess carbon dioxide. So even if we exploited the Southern Ocean to its maximum potential as an area suitable for the kind of algal blooms that would work effectively over the long term, it could account, we think, it's thought at best, for about a tenth of the anticipated carbon dioxide emissions over this century. But the form of geoengineering most likely to be deployed is known as sulfate aerosol injection. Now, the proposal is to spray sulfur dioxide or sulfuric acid into the upper atmosphere, into the stratosphere, to form tiny particles, aerosols, that would reflect an extra 1 or 2% of incoming solar radiation back into space, thereby cooling the planet. The aim would be to mimic the effects of volcanoes. The particles spewed into the atmosphere by large volcanic eruptions have been known, for 100 years or so, to cool the planet by perhaps 1 or more degrees for perhaps up to a couple of years. These volcanic eruptions, large ones, also change the colour of the sky. They tend to make it whiter, except that sunsets and sunrises when they produce very vivid red skies, particularly at sunsets, as you know, after a big bushfire, for example, the particulate matter in the atmosphere will give us particularly vivid sunsets. And in fact, in 1883, there were spectacular sunsets in Oslo after the eruption of Mount Krakatoa off the coast of Java. And these spectacular sunsets in Oslo were witnessed by the painter Edvard Munch, who wrote in his diary that he saw these sunsets and he felt a great scream emanate from nature. He went back to his studios and he painted the scream. Now, there are other stories about the impact of volcanic eruptions, on artistic emanations. For example, in 1816, an enormous volcanic eruption, it's in the book, but I forget the name of it, Mount Toba, I think, again in the Indonesian archipelago, led to what was known, it actually occurred in 1815, but in 1816, a few months later in Europe, they had what was known as the year without a summer. And during that summer of 1816, a young woman known as Mary Godwin, an 18-year-old, was holidaying in the Swiss Alps with a couple of friends, and they were going to go trekking for a couple of weeks, but the weather was so miserable, cold and wet this summer, that they were constrained to stay indoors. And so one evening, they're getting a bit of cabin fever, so they set themselves the task of telling ghost stories. And Mary Godwin went to bed and had a dream of a horror story, and she got up the next day and next evening told her friends, who were Lord Byron and Percy Bysshe Shelley, the story of Frankenstein. And of course, she, Mary Godwin, married Shelley and became Mary Shelley. The subtitle of Frankenstein is Story of Prometheus. So the most likely delivery method for sulfate aerosol spraying is a fleet of customised high-flying aircraft fitted with tanks and special spraying equipment, although a hose suspended in the sky is also being investigated. In effect, humans would be installing a radiative shield between the Earth and the Sun, one that could be adjusted by those who control it to regulate the temperature of the Earth. Well, how effective would such a solar filter be in suppressing warming? And these are a pair of charts from one of the most cited studies, modelling studies, looking at the impact of solar radiation management through sulfate aerosol spraying. You can see in the top panel here, the estimated warming of the globe, temperature change across the globe as a result of a doubling of carbon dioxide emissions, which is something we will get to on business as usual in a couple of decades, maybe three decades. And you can see it's hotter at the poles. And then they said, well, what happens in our model if we have this same level of global warming associated with a doubling of CO2, but we turn down the amount of sunlight, solar radiation, reaching the Earth by 1.84%. And you can see it largely neutralises the effect, the warming effect on the planet, although you've still got a degree or so, a degree, maybe 2 degrees, even at the poles. However, when you look at the impact of this kind of warming plus sulfate aerosol spraying, when you look at the impact on precipitation, on rainfall around the planet, the effects are much more uneven. And one of the concerns is that solar radiation management with global warming may shift the Indian monsoon, affecting food supplies for a very large number of people. Moreover, the solar shield, this kind of solar shield, would, as carbon dioxide emissions into the atmosphere increase, do nothing to offset the acidification of the oceans, as oceans absorb carbon dioxide from the atmosphere through an equilibration process. And against these kinds of modelling studies that show that it would be effective at offsetting global warming, other atmospheric scientists argue that the complexity of the climate system means that it's impossible to draw any firm conclusions about the consequences of such a radical intervention in the Earth system. They point out, for example, that the chemistry of the atmosphere, which isn't taken into account in these modelling studies, the chemistry is complicated. So turning down the amount of sunlight reaching the Earth in a model can actually give little clue as to what would happen in the actual climate system. One important question is how the extra sulfur compounds put into the stratosphere would interact with the ozone layer. The most comprehensive study concluded, and here these charts illustrate that, that in injecting enough sulfur into the stratosphere to suppress the warming associated with a doubling of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, a doubling of concentrations, would indeed deplete the ozone layer in polar regions, delaying the recovery of the Antarctic ozone hole by 30 to 70 years. Other studies indicate, as I suggested, that the Indian monsoon could be seriously disrupted, although the disruption could be less serious than may occur in a scenario of warming without the solar filter. Even so, our understanding of the influences on the monsoon is weak, and our knowledge of how global warming would change the monsoon is weaker, and trying to estimate the combined influence of warming and solar radiation management is little more than educated guesswork. Who knows what would happen to rainfall patterns? But if catastrophe ensued after sulfate spraying, at least we would know whom to blame. Or would we? And here we get to one of the strongest objections or risks with sulfate aerosol spraying. We cannot know how it would affect the global climate system through modelling or even by conducting experiments. Only by full-scale implementation could we get a clear idea of its impacts. Even then, it's estimated that we would need 10 years of data on the global climate before we had enough information to separate out the effects of sulfate aerosol spraying from natural variability and indeed from the effects of human-induced warming. The levels of omniscience and omnipotence required to make it work really would have us playing God. To compound the risks, if after 10 years, when we accumulated enough data to decide that our intervention was not a good idea, it may be impossible to terminate the solar shield. Why should this be so? Well, for some time, ecologists have known that the rate at which the globe warms is a greater threat to ecosystems than the amount of warming, because a slower rate of warming gives plants and ecosystems more time to adapt. At a warming rate of 0.3 degrees centigrade per decade, so a third of a degree per decade, it's been estimated only 30% of ecosystems can adapt. Now, according to one study, here in the upper chart, projected rates of warming, they're actually associated with a range of estimates of so-called climate sensitivity. That's the extent to which the globe is estimated to warm as a result of doubling of carbon dioxide concentrations, and the usual estimate is 3 degrees. So take a kind of middle path here in this rainbow of possibilities in that upper panel. So that's the likely warming associated with business as usual through to the end of the century. What would happen, the scientist asked, if we imposed a solar shield, a sulfate aerosol shield, in 2020 and kept it for 40 years and then decided, for whatever reason, that we had to stop spraying sulfuric acid or whatever we're using into the upper atmosphere. Let's say there was some extreme unintended side effects, there was a global conflict, the technology failed for some reason, and we had to stop it. Well, what we see from this chart is the suppressed warming suddenly takes off. And in the first decade or two, you get an astonishing and disturbing rate of warming of the planet. In fact, in the first decade, you'd see a surge in average temperature by 1.3 degrees centigrade. And remember, I said that it's estimated separately that a one-third, 0.3 degree warming in a decade would see only 30% of ecosystems able to adapt. Few ecosystems could survive the first decade of rapid heating after the solar shield had been turned off. So once deployed, it's likely that we'd become dependent on our solar filter, the more so if we failed to take the opportunity while it was in place to cut greenhouse gas emissions sharply. And this, I think, is the solar filter's most dangerous drawback. Well, a constituency advocating investment in major research into geoengineering has now emerged and is gaining influence. At the centre of this network is a pair of influential North American scientists actively engaged in geoengineering research, and they are David Keith, a Harvard physicist, and Ken Caldera, an atmospheric scientist based at Stanford University. And just by way of a digression, but I think an important one, it's worth noting that Ken Caldera spent 10 years before he went to Stanford at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, the Cold War nuclear weapons research facility just outside San Francisco. And researching this book, Earth Masters, it occurred to me after several months that there's a disproportionate number of scientists engaged in geoengineering research in the United States that have links to the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, and that the worldview of Livermore seems to pervade some elements of the geoengineering research community. What is this worldview? Well, it's a technocratic rationalist worldview, confident of humanity's ability to use technology to control nature. It's a worldview that naturally privileges technical expertise and which, during the Cold War, fiercely opposed limits on its activities through nuclear test bans. At Livermore, Ken Caldera came under the influence of a legendary scientist known as Lowell Wood. He was a Cold War weaponeer, nicknamed Dr. Evil, a nickname in which he apparently revels. In 1997, Lowell Wood, co-authored with Edward Teller, and for those perhaps younger members of the audience, Edward Teller was an extremely important figure in post-war United States and indeed the world. He has been described as the father of the hydrogen bomb. Here he is patting one. He was the nuclear weapons scientist who was a very important architect of the Cold War. And he was, for example, often called upon to help the Pentagon choose targets in the Soviet Union on which the nuclear missiles would be deployed. And he was, Teller was the model for the Dr. Strangelove character in the famous movie of that name. Now, the interesting thing is that Lowell Wood co-authored with Edward Teller one of the first papers in 1997 advocating sulfate aerosol spraying as a response to global warming. And in, soon after this paper, in an opinion piece published in the Wall Street Journal, Edward Teller claimed that the jury is still out on global warming. He deplored what he called the, quote, all-out war on people who use fossil fuels. Instead, he wrote, "Let's play to our uniquely American strengths in innovation and technology to offset any global warming by the least costly means possible." In a follow-up paper a few years later, Teller and Wood argued that sulfate aerosol spraying is not only technologically easier, politically preferable, and environmentally benign, but it has large economic benefits, and we should be deploying the solar filter no matter what. The economic benefits would include a reduction in levels of skin cancer. For some years, David Keith and Ken Caldera have been Bill Gates's principal source of expert knowledge on climate change science. Gates was persuaded to commit several million dollars to finance research into geoengineering. And incidentally, Richard Branson is also promoting geoengineering as a response to climate change. If you go to his website, which he calls the Carbon War Room, you'll see what Branson is up to on geoengineering. There's a kind of messiah complex that pervades the whole thing. Bill Gates is now the world's leading financial supporter of geoengineering research. He's an investor in various geoengineering enterprises, including one called Silver Lining, a company pursuing marine cloud brightening methods. He's an investor in a company called Carbon Engineering Limited, a startup founded by David Keith to develop and commercialise air capture technology. Gates is also an investor in a firm known as Intellectual Ventures. Lowell Wood and Ken Caldera are associated with it as well. The company was founded and is led by a man called Nathan Myhrvold, formerly Chief Technology Officer at Microsoft. And the company has developed what it calls the Strato Shield, a hose suspended by balloons in the sky to deliver sulfate aerosols. And as you can see, the device is marketed as a practical, low-cost way to reverse catastrophic warming in the Arctic or the entire planet. If billionaires are destined to be the investors in geoengineering, then perhaps Bill Gates should be on top of our preferred list. Certainly, I think many of us would be much more anxious if it were the Koch brothers or Gina Rinehart. After all, Bill Gates' altruistic motives are well recognised through his laudable work with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And indeed, I was having a debate about geoengineering in Melbourne a week or so ago with Peter Singer, and Peter Singer said, well, what's wrong with Bill Gates? He's a good guy. You know, isn't he well motivated? Why are you worried, Clive? But the question here is not so much the motives a billionaire like Bill Gates might bring to geoengineering, not his motives, but his worldview that I think deserves some thought. Bill Gates has been dismissive of renewable energy and energy efficiency measures as solutions to global warming. He has dismissed solar energy as cute. With his background, he's inclined to see any roadblock as requiring a technological breakthrough. He said that what we need to solve climate change are energy miracles performed by, quote, crazy energy entrepreneurs. Yet we face a climate crisis not because we lack alternatives to fossil fuels, but because the political resolve to ensuring that they're taken up is absent for a variety of structural reasons, including the power of the fossil fuel lobby, the resistance of the public to changes in their consumption patterns. I mean, think how much Australian punters scream when petrol prices go up. And the widespread prevalence of various psychological strategies of evasion and denial of climate science. Gates and other entrepreneurs want to find a kind of killer app for what is a social and political problem. The kind of techno-fix mentality that's inclined to see planetary geoengineering as a way of cutting through the hard politics of emission reduction. In recent years, there's been a flurry of patents taken out over methods to engineer the climate. One of them, patented in the US, is so broad that if enforceable, it would place fertilisation of the oceans in the hands of one man. So we're approaching a situation in which international efforts to protect humanity from climate disaster could depend on whether or not one company wants to sell its intellectual property. Oil companies, anticipating a shift in the political landscape, are quietly backing research into geoengineering. Royal Dutch Shell is funding a study of liming the seas. The chief scientist at the oil giant, BP, was a convener of an expert meeting that, in 2009, produced an influential report on climate engineering as a response to climate emergencies. ExxonMobil, for years the principal funder of climate science disinformation, has inserted itself into climate engineering. The corporation's point man on geoengineering is named Haroon Keshki, who leads its global climate change program. In 1995, Keshki, when he was at the Lawrence Livermore Laboratories, was the first to propose liming the oceans as a means of reducing acidification. Through Keshki, Exxon has begun to influence various independent reports into geoengineering, including one prepared by NASA in 2007. Burgeoning commercial engagement in geoengineering is creating a constituency with an interest in more research and, eventually, deployment. Such a lobby is naturally predisposed to argue that pursuing emission cuts is unrealistic and politically infeasible, and therefore geoengineering is the sensible alternative. This is the slippery slope concern about researching geoengineering. Already, the chorus of demands for public funding is loud, and governments are beginning to show interest. China recently decided to include geoengineering among its earth science research priorities, initiating, I think, a marked shift in the international climate change landscape. It's fair to expect that if we reach the stage of deployment, any move to terminate it, due, for example, to evidence of unexpected environmental damage or perhaps international conflict, would be fought by the new industry with complaints of asset devaluation and job losses. Today it might seem absurd that factors like these should play a role in determining the fate of the entire planet, but the history of environmental policy making shows that these kinds of decisions are never based solely on scientific considerations. All of which points to perhaps the greatest risk of research into geoengineering. It will erode the incentive to cut emissions. In a political and commercial environment where cutting emissions appears too hard, geoengineering arrives as the next great white hope. Economists like the authors of Superfreakonomics have seized on it. Here you've got it. In the title, Global Cooling. It's all about solar radiation management. Why are we screwing around trying to cut carbon emissions? Let's just do it. That's what they argue, and in actually words cruder than those I just used. Already in the United States, right-wing think tanks like the American Enterprise Institute and indeed the Heartland Institute, which have for years promoted denial of climate science, are now advocating geoengineering as a substitute for cutting emissions. Geoengineering promises to turn a drastic failure of the free enterprise system into a triumph of human ingenuity. Instead of climate change being a vindication of environmentalist warnings, climate engineering exposes environmentalists' lack of faith in humanity. Instead of blaming technological hubris, the call is for greater mastery over nature. Which government would not be enticed by the techno-fix to beat all techno-fixes? Think about it. No need to take on powerful fossil fuel companies. No need to tax petrol and electricity. No need to ask consumers to change their lifestyles. And instead of global warming being proof of human failure, geoengineering could be humanity's finest hour. In short, while climate change threatens to destabilise the system, geoengineering promises to protect it. Yet beneath it all lies a gnawing question. What kind of beings have we become when we believe that we can use technology to take control of the climate system of the planet as a whole and regulate it to suit our needs for thousands of years to come? Faith in techno-fixes brings a distinctively American worldview to climate engineering. There is, of course, a long history of criticism of techno-fixes in the United States. Yet implicit faith in humanity's ability to overcome threats and master the environment defined the science as savior culture of that nation in the post-war decades. The Promethean ambition of planetary control, perhaps expressed most starkly by Lowell Wood, Dr. Evil, when he declared, "We've engineered every other environment we live in, why not the planet?" This Promethean ambition is harder to defend in Europe. In Western Europe, and especially Germany, geoengineering is regarded with more circumspection and anxiety. Even so, my guess is that China is the country most likely to be tempted to take control of the global climate. To finish, I'll just make this comment. It shouldn't be thought that those more anxious about global warming are always more likely to support climate engineering, just as it should not be thought that those who deny global warming science necessarily reject geoengineering. Yet among those who believe we should make preparations to engineer the climate, people like Paul Crutzen, there's a sharp division between those who see it as a way of defending the established order so that expansion, growth can continue uninterrupted, and those, I think Crutzen fits into this latter category, those who see it as a necessary evil, a regrettable means of protecting the deeper values now threatened by the consequences of endless expansion, the values of, or the benefits of viable societies, vulnerable communities, ecological values, and indeed life itself. I believe that within the next decade, we will all be compelled to take a stance on geoengineering. The prospects are slim that the nations of the world will overcome their reluctance to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions sharply and begin what they should have begun a decade ago. As we feel the effects of a warming globe in ever more acute ways, the demand for a rapid response will become intense, perhaps irresistible. Managing the climate, one way or another, is humanity's great challenge for the 21st century. Just how confident are we that we can use technology to take control of and regulate the biggest and most complex ecosystem of them all? Thank you.
This and all previous episodes of the show are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. It's only the second show we've done on geoengineering, but there is a geoengineering category. On the other hand, we've done over 20 shows on climate change. So if you're at this episode's webpage, you can click on one of the category links at the bottom to see the other episodes that we've broadcast in the same category. I appreciate not only Clive Hamilton's handle on the details of different methods of geoengineering or different proposed mechanisms, but his questioning of the whole ethos. Should this be done for private gain? Should this be done at all? Are we, as Charles Eisenstein suggests, going down a fundamentally wrong road, applying technofix after technofix with ever-increasing costs? Well, learning that CIA is funding research in this area certainly doesn't give me confidence, and I'm reminded of how a lot of other new technologies are introduced with false promises. The drones, perhaps, you thought were only going to be used for foreign countries. Now it seems there's pretty much a global system rolling out there. Stories about using tasers only in extreme situations as a replacement for bullets. Now what do we see? Police are tasering people who disobey what they say. And it strikes me that, particularly with an ethos of private profit, selfish benefit at the expense of others, as is more or less explicit in any sort of financial system using money, we can't expect good things from changing the climate. If you'd like to comment on this show, there's a discussion tab on the webpage. If you'd like to comment on future shows, suggest new speakers, or give feedback, you can join the mailing list at altruists.org/unwelcome. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. I'm always keen to hear your feedback, and I'd especially like to thank Payden Stevens last week, who gave me great encouragement, which I got at just the right time.